So today, this sutta is from the Salayatana Samyutta, and this is number 35 in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is this big book, one of my favourites, if not my very favourites, of the Tipitaka. And perhaps because each chapter is arranged by theme, it's really nice if you want to go into detail and in depth in a particular subject, but also it has a lot of very straight Dhamma, straight to the heart of the teachings. And this particular chapter is about the senses. So that means the sense of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and the mind. So in the Buddha's teachings, there are always known to be six senses, and sometimes they're differentiated in the sense that the five senses are those things that we tend to indulge and we tend to seek our happiness through, because most of us don't really know how to find the happiness in the mind. And so we're pretty much led by our senses. You know, if something feels good, like at the physical level and the emotional level, really, but, you know, say unpleasant touch, then we feel immediately unhappy. Some of you have got headaches. I don't know if you're managing to remain happy inside your mind, but quite often we lose our happiness when we come in contact with unwanted physical sensations. And the same thing at the eye sense door, you know, we like to see beautiful sights and not ugly sights. We like to smell fragrant smells, like the wonderful bread and butter pudding that somebody made for us today here at the monastery. It smelled wonderful. I came down and said, wow, it smells like the Deva realm, even though I don't really know that the Deva realm smells like bread and butter pudding. But I'm sure, you know, the Deva realm can smell however you want it to in your mind, right? You know, and we really cringe at what we perceive as repugnant smells. I remember when my dad came to India, and he must have quite a strong sense of smell, I think. And it's interesting in India because you walk around one corner and there's this really overwhelming smell of incense or maybe flowers, you know, from a flower market, and around the next corner, there's all this garbage on the streets and sort of rotting food, and it can be really quite intense. And he kept going and making a very expressive face. So we're really kind of led by our nose in that case. Sometimes we think that doesn't matter, but actually they've shown that even in kind of relationships, like romantic relationships, a lot of that is led by smell. You know, we probably don't think that we're falling in love with somebody's armpits, but actually there are certain kinds of smell that, you know, resonate with us somehow and suggest a certain possibility for compatibility, perhaps. Anyway, and sight, sound, smell, taste. This is a big one, isn't it? How do you feel if you have a really plain meal or a meal that just has something you really dislike, like too much celery? I don't know. Some people don't like peppers. It kind of spoils the whole meal and we get grumpy, we get upset. And more than this, we're constantly in pursuit of the pleasant. Yeah. And this is one of the things that really deprives us of our energy and in a sense directs us to a place that can never really fulfill. So sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Touch we've talked about, and there's also the mind. So the mind, of course, is probably the most tricky, subtle, and slippery area, and yet one of the most important. Because even when, you know, we have our eyes closed in meditation and there's no particularly strong sights, sounds, or smells, most probably, we can fantasize about those things. We bring them up in our mind and we crave for having them again, you know, in the future. We remember the time that, you know, we experience something very unpleasant and we get really down, we get really depressed. So the mind is very important. And in a sense, the Buddha says that the whole world resides in the mind. The mind is the forerunner of the world that we create. And quite often when he talked about the world, he actually meant the world of these six senses. That is the world. And yet he also said that the mind is different because the happiness of the mind can actually be and should be cultivated. Whereas the happiness of the senses, it's not that you should, you know, torture yourself and not enjoy the things that you enjoy, but we shouldn't pursue that realm because ultimately the happiness that's available there is limited. Whereas the pleasure of the mind, when it's based on ethical conduct, when it's based on beautiful qualities that we're developing in our heart, doesn't have the same drawback. There's actually nothing to be feared. The Buddha said, you know, there's nothing to be feared. It should be cultivated and developed. So the happiness of the mind is something he recommends. And anyway, that's just a little bit of introduction because the sutta itself doesn't go into those different types of happiness. But I like this because it's a very evocative and visual simile for the way that the senses work and the way that we can learn to restrain those senses. So for anyone here for the first time, that's about as much of a input as I'll give. I might make a few comments as we go through, but it is a discussion. So we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of the etymology or the comparative studies or anything like that, partly because I'm tired, but partly mainly because this group is for everybody here to find out how this can apply to our everyday lives and enrich our practice. And I also love the topic of sense restraint, sometimes called guarding or governing the senses, because it's an area of practice that is very rarely taught. And that is really an area of practice that pertains to not only our meditation, but to everything we do throughout the day. So it's kind of that realm between your sort of more heightened mindfulness that we can cultivate on the cushion through meditation and the kind of grosser conduct of body and speech. You know, many of us might be good at observing the precepts or having basic ethical conduct of body and speech, but how are we behaving at the level of the mind? What is our mental behavior? So sense restraint starts to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, say, the deep meditation on the cushion or even the shallow meditation on the cushion, and, you know, just living an ethical life by noticing how we're being pulled out and where these unwholesome states arise. Does that make sense? Yeah? So it's a huge area of practice and one that is very helpful also to be aware of, especially at the end of a meditation. When we open our eyes, we can notice straight away, okay, so now I'm seeing something. You know, how am I relating to the impressions that arise? You know, what am I letting arise between the eye and the sight? There's a whole area there of awareness. We can sometimes see how the defilements start to creep in or how the craving starts to creep in. You see something pleasant, I want more of it. You go towards, you know, I don't know, maybe a person you're attracted to, or you feel repelled from somebody else. So if we can start to catch it at that level, then we can restrain our senses, and that will help us not to move into unwholesome actions of body and speech. So without any further explanation, I think I'll get into reading the sutta. And the page number is 1255. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it's chapter 35, and it's number 247. In brackets, it says 10, I'm not sure why. So, yeah, it's just 247, the simile of the six animals. So, let's see what the Buddha has to say. Perhaps one of our co-hosts could write that reference in. And then if you have the book, you can follow, but don't worry if not, I'll read it out in full. And then we'll have some discussion. So it's quite a long sutta. But feel free to interrupt me at any point if you have a question or comment that clarifies the reading. But we'll try and get through the whole sutta first and then have some discussion. I feel that gives the session a bit more flow. So just if there's a question about the meaning, you know, just to clarify the terminology, then feel free to raise your virtual hand at the bottom or type something in the chat. Okay. So someone's put the Sutta Central link and the Bhikkhu Bodhi translation, which is the one that I'm using. And after the class, if you want, you can read other translations to bring out more nuance. So here we go. Bhikkhus. Okay, so this is addressing the monks, but I'll say community since we are actually, we don't have any monks here. We only have one bhikkhuni and an anagarika sitting next to me and lots of lay people. So community, suppose a person with limbs wounded and festering would enter a wood of thorny reeds. And the kusa thorns would prick at his feet or their feet. Hang on, is this the right one? Yes, this is the right one. Okay, I'm starting again because I'm a bit tired and I want to get the flow properly. So thank you for your patience. I'll start it again. Okay, because I'm also going to change a man to a person just to make it gender inclusive. So community, suppose a person with limbs wounded and festering would enter a wood of thorny reeds, and the kusa thorns would prick their feet, and the reed blades would slash their limbs. Thus, that person would thereby experience even more pain and displeasure. So too, community or monastics, some person here, gone to the village or the forest, meets someone who reproaches them thus. This venerable one, acting in such a way, behaving in such a way, is a foul village thorn. Having understood this person thus as a thorn, one should understand restraint and non-restraint. And how, monastics, is there non-restraint? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a person is intent upon a pleasing form and repelled by a displeasing form. They dwell without having set up mindfulness of the body, with a limited mind, and they do not understand as it really is that liberation of mind by wisdom, wherein those bad, I'm going to say bad, it says evil here, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear, a person is intent upon a pleasing sound and repelled by a displeasing sound. They dwell without having set up mindfulness of the body with a limited mind, and they do not understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those bad, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having cognized a mental phenomena, so we've got form. Oh, I think I skipped a few, actually. So the second one should have been, sound with the ear. Oh, it skipped everything. Okay, so I'll just fill in the bit that it skipped, because here it's going from the eye to the sound and then to the mental phenomena. So in between, there should also be the tongue and being intent on a pleasant taste, and the ear being intent on a pleasing sound. So sight, sound, smell, a pleasing smell, being repelled by a displeasing smell. Sight, sound, smell. Taste, we did. Touch, a pleasing touch and repelled by a displeasing touch. And then it gets to the last one, having cognized a mental phenomena with the mind, One is intent upon a pleasing mental phenomena and repelled by a displeasing mental phenomena. One dwells without having set up mindfulness of the body with a limited mind and does not understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Okay, is that clear or confusing? I got a bit thrown by the dot, dot, dots. Are you hearing me okay? Yes. Okay. All right. So we'll carry on because there's a simile that will bring out the meaning here. Suppose, community or people, a person would catch six animals with different domains and feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. They would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey, and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, they would tie the ropes together with a knot in the middle and release them. So here you've got all these animals tied together with a knot in the middle, but the whole rope is not actually attached to anything. It's just kind of free and wandering around, right? So all these animals are basically tied together with a knot in the middle. Then those six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground or domain. The snake would pull one way, thinking, let me enter an anthill. The crocodile would pull another way, thinking, let me enter the water. The bird would pull another way, thinking, let me fly up into the sky. The dog would pull up another way, thinking, let me enter a village. And the jackal would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a charnel ground. And the monkey, which stands for the mind, of course, would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a forest. Now, when those six animals become worn out and fatigued, they would be dominated by the one among them that was strongest. They would submit to it and come under its control. So too, monastics or community, when a person has not developed and cultivated mindfulness directed to the body, the eye pulls in the direction of agreeable forms and disagreeable forms are repulsive. The ear pulls in the direction of agreeable sounds and disagreeable sounds are repulsive. The nose pulls in the direction of agreeable odours and disagreeable odours are repulsive. The tongue pulls in the direction of agreeable tastes and disagreeable tastes are repulsive. The body pulls in the direction of agreeable tactile objects and disagreeable tactile objects are repulsive. The mind pulls in the direction of agreeable mental phenomena and disagreeable mental phenomena are repulsive. It is in such a way that there is non-restraint. Okay, so this is a sort of definition of non-restraint that's slightly different from the standard. I think I've probably taught here before that the standard one is that when coming in contact with, say, a form through the eye, one does not grasp at its signs and features, because if one left the eye unguarded, unwholesome states would invade the mind, something like this. So that's about not kind of, Ajahn Brahm used the word, getting sucked in to particular attributes of an object that would create unwholesome mental states, lust or aversion or maybe delusion, not being really clear about what it is that you're seeing. But here, restraint is being described as being pulled towards the agreeable and being repelled from the disagreeable. Yeah. So it's slightly different there. And it's also talking about this almost like a competition, isn't it, between the different senses. It's like whichever thing, whichever sensory input is most stimulating, most desirable, strongest, is going to take your attention. You know, as if these senses are vying for our attention all the time and we're just flitting around between one and the other. You know, whether it's the five external senses or the mind that's, you know, being pulled around by the mental contents, the mental objects that arise in the mind, which are, of course, usually related to the five sense world. Unless we're thinking about the Dhamma, which is something quite wholesome to do. But most of the time, we're actually thinking about sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches, and where we're going to get the next ones from, the nice ones, the pleasant ones, or how we can improve upon the ones we have. So in this case, these animals are getting very, very weary, right? Because they're pulling in all kinds of directions and being really led astray. And although they're knotted together in the middle, that they're not actually tied to a post. So the post in this simile is mindfulness of the body. And that is what is missing. So it's another example of how restraint and mindfulness, and in this case, mindfulness of the body in particular, go together, work together, and depend upon each other. And you'll see the same thing in the gradual training. In, for example, Majjhima Nikaya number 51, and number 128, I think, as well. And other discourses on the gradual training, which are found mostly in the Dhammanikaya. So mindfulness and guarding of the senses usually come together. Sometimes one comes first and the other comes afterwards. But we need to be aware of what's happening in our mind before we can understand how to exercise that restraint. And the more we're able to be restrained or guarded in our use of the senses, the stronger our mindfulness is going to grow, because we're not wearying our mind. We're not exhausting ourselves by being dragged around in this realm of the senses. So the next part is almost the opposite of that. So I'll continue to finish this sutta. And how, monastics or community, is their restraint? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a person is not intent upon a pleasing form and not repelled by a displeasing form. They dwell having set up mindfulness of the body with a measureless mind, and they understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil or bad, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Having heard a sound with the ear, and then it skips. So then we want having smelled a smell with the nose, having tasted a taste with the tongue, having felt a touch with the body, and then the last one, having cognized a mental phenomena with the mind, one is not intent upon a pleasing mental phenomena and not repelled by a displeasing mental phenomenon. One dwells having set up mindfulness of the body with a measureless mind, and they understand as it really is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, wherein those evil or bad, unwholesome states cease without remainder. It is in such a way that there's restraint. So it's quite a deep sutta, because it's going here from having set up the mindfulness of the body and then in the same sentence with a measureless mind. So usually a measureless mind refers to the mind in jhana, in deep meditation. And in the gradual training too, it usually starts off with mindfulness of the body and then goes to the practice of samadhi. And then even further than that, it talks about liberation through wisdom. So this is even beyond those samadhi states and understanding things as they really are, even understanding that liberation of mind, which in some contexts in the suttas is understanding that those states too are fabricated. They're also conditioned. And going to this, the ceasing of unwholesome states ceasing without remainder is usually a description of the arahat, somebody who cannot anymore generate any state based on greed, hate, and delusion, because those things have been uprooted, cut off at the root, like a tree stump, it often says, or a palm stump, no longer subject to re-arising. So it is in such a way that there's restraint. And I'm sure there's a lot that happens in between, which we can probably flesh out. So suppose, monastics, community, a person would catch six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds and tie them by a strong rope. They would catch a snake, a crocodile, a bird, a dog, a jackal, and a monkey, and tie each by a strong rope. Having done so, they would bind them to a strong post or pillar. Then those six animals with different domains and different feeding grounds would each pull in the direction of its own feeding ground and domain. The snake would pull one way, thinking, let me enter an anthill, etc., etc. And the monkey would pull another way, thinking, let me enter a forest. Now, when those six animals become worn out and fatigued, they would stand close to that post or pillar. They would sit down there. They would lie down there. So too, bhikkhus, or monastics, or community. When a person has developed and cultivated mindfulness directed to the body, the eye does not pull in the direction of agreeable forms, nor are disagreeable forms repulsive. The ear does not pull in the direction of agreeable sounds, nor are disagreeable sounds repulsive. Same for the nose, same for the tongue, same for the body, and also the mind. The mind does not pull in the direction of agreeable mental phenomena, nor a disagreeable mental phenomena repulsive. It is in such a way that there is restraint. Just a note here before we finish off. But it's not actually saying that we won't anymore get disagreeable sounds, sights, smells, tastes, touches, or even mental phenomena. But we're not intent on them, we're not pulled towards them, and we don't find them repulsive. That's a measure of equanimity right there. A strong post or pillar. This, monastics, is a designation for mindfulness directed to the body. Therefore, community, you should train yourselves thus. We will develop and cultivate mindfulness directed to the body. Make it our vehicle. Make it our basis. Stabilize it. Exercise ourselves in it and fully perfect it. Thus should you train yourselves. Okay. I just heard that my voice is quiet. I'm speaking quite loud. I mean, I'll try and speak louder, but I'll do my best. Is it okay for most people here? Yeah? Okay, I'll try and speak a bit louder. Okay, so people have their hands up. That was quite a long sort of reading, so let's get stuck right in. So it'd be lovely to hear from Benjamin. Ah, there's crackling in the background. Oh. Okay. Can you unmute? Hi.
This seems to be talking about mindfulness directed to the body as a long-term practice that ultimately leads to this stability. And I'm wondering whether it also could be that mindfulness directed to the body is something you could apply on a given occasion when these kinds of pulling forces arise to utilize them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right in both cases, like mindfulness of the body. The Buddha here is talking about it almost like a foundation for the practice, right? That we should make it our vehicle, our basis, stabilize it, exercise ourselves in it, and fully perfect it. And in a sense, I mean, whatever factor of the path you work on, whatever practice you take as your main practice will ultimately inform the other practices that you do. So to take mindfulness of the body would not be limiting you in any way, but rather making a really strong foundation. And I think from this sutta, we can also see that you know, in that one sentence, it says one dwells having set up mindfulness of the body, and then comma, with a measureless mind, comma, and understands it as it really is, that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. So in my experience of the practice, no matter where you start from, at some point, when the practice deepens, you will also experience a measure of samadhi, you know, that will naturally take you into what is known as the liberations of mind, because the mindfulness will become so strong that you'll start to experience something of one-pointedness, something of the mind merging with its object. And it's just a different way into that. But certainly for people who are practicing, mindfulness of the body is one of the easiest ways to establish the mindfulness that helps us to restrain the senses in everyday life. Because unless we're actually aware of, it's just much easier to be aware of the body than it is to be aware of abstract mental states. You know, sometimes we find ourselves in a bad mood and we don't even understand why. But if we're actually practicing with being aware of the body and the feelings in the body, most often we realize that we're actually grumpy with the feelings themselves. And we attribute that to something outside. Someone said such and such, or someone didn't show up on time. But actually what you're averse to is that feeling of contraction or the thought process that's coming up around it. And it's actually something you can directly observe. So by staying at that level of contact, direct level of experience, you're more likely to be able to notice when unwholesome states start to arise and change your relationship with your felt experience. And that was my practice for the first 14 years of my monastic life. And I think it's still pretty established. I mean, not 100% of the time, because I'm not actively kind of directing my mind to the body again and again as the main object in my practice, but it certainly serves me very well and makes it easy to come back to something real. And I can start to notice where a reaction that's wholesome or unwholesome actually comes from, but especially the unwholesome. Yeah. To the point where, you know, we can actually be feeling quite ill or really quite drained, for example, physically, but we start to learn to notice the qualities of the mind. First of all, we have equanimity to the unpleasant feelings, physical feelings, and that enables us to then see that underneath that, there's actually a lot to be grateful for.
Yeah,
we have
a couple of times when I've experienced really serious illnesses where I'm totally laid flat. Actually, you can get into really peaceful states because of that, not just because of that. And I wonder if partly that might be because the attention is brought automatically to the body, and the body is by its nature always in the present.
Exactly that. You know, it's interesting because I'm glad you've had that experience. Ajahn Brahm had a disciple at one point who used to get terrible migraine headaches to the point that he was completely incapacitated. And because he came in contact with the meditation instructions but couldn't avoid the headaches, he started to use the pain of the migraine as his object, and he would just go inside it. And this isn't for everyone. Sometimes it's not advisable to really zoom in on a pain if it's, you know, just leading to more and more reactivity. But in this case, his mindfulness was strong enough to really go inside it. And I think he had no choice. It was like they say, your back's against the wall, right? His head was splitting into I don't know how many pieces. So he would just penetrate that pain to the point that he actually didn't feel it anymore. He sort of went through it and into these deep states of jhana meditation where he couldn't feel any of the five senses. And at some point in his practice, I mean, this was the unfortunate side, he didn't get the migraine anymore, which you might think is a wonderful thing. But because that had been his only method, he also couldn't enter those deep meditations anymore either. So I think you're right. I mean, it can be helpful. And obviously, that's an extreme example. But the body is always, the feelings in the body are always here and now. And that's why most often when I start to teach meditation at the beginning, I'll start to do a guided body scan just to bring us out of the realm of concepts and ideas and, you know, evaluations of our life and our mood or whatever, and just have a direct experience in the present, something real. Yeah. Yeah. I'll come to Joseph. I'd really like to talk more about the practice of mindfulness of the body if other people have experience with those practices or how you might practice. So, Joseph.
Thank you, Venerable. I find concrete examples really helpful when reading the suttas, just the way the mind works. What came to mind was thinking about this teaching in terms of, like, if one remains a lay practitioner and one. So my question is, how does one relate to sense restraint and the concept of anumodana, rejoicing and generosity? Because I was thinking literally of, like, I remember you have certain dietary restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about, you know, how finding, being in a market, walking through a market and seeing, oh, almonds or eggs. And like, Venerable can have as many of these as she wants. I should get lots of these.
I'm so glad you've studied my diet. Really sweet.
And then being repelled by, oh, no, she can't eat any of that. That'll give her a stomach ache.
Uh-huh.
And so rejoicing in generosity. So I've heard that the near enemy of mudita is like this kind of excitement. And when I asked, I think it was Lumpur Pasano about that, he said mindfulness of the body. So I'm seeing a connection here about how do we maintain this kind of restraint, but also rejoicing in generosity. Mm-hmm. That's just what I felt inspired to ask you about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, I haven't really thought about that connection before very much, but I think it would relate to the arising and the inclining of the mind towards the wholesome state. Because mudita is something very beautiful. So if we're actually cultivating wholesome states, then naturally at that time, the mind is not leaning towards the opposite. But the excitement that can come along is what the Buddha talks about. I mean, he doesn't actually, I don't think he actually uses the word excitement as the near enemy. I think that's from the Visuddhimagga that they talk about the near and the far enemies. But one of them that can arise is, yeah, a kind of excitement or a sort of frivolousness. So something a little bit, I suppose it's like a bubbly excitement, and it tips into sort of something that actually, rather than resources the mind, starts to drain the mind and starts to lead towards craving and sort of clinging to that, you know. So it loses its groundedness. It loses that aspect of equanimity that should really go alongside it. And the other one, of course, is a kind of stinginess, I would say, is one of the enemies to or impurities of joy. It's probably the near enemy, like the obvious enemy, and also envy or jealousy. So I think it's perfectly fine to, you know, rejoice in one's generosity. And if that's generosity in terms of offering food or something that smells pleasant to us and that we think the other person's going to enjoy, that's a very, it's actually helping us to change our relationship with the sense objects, for example, food, from one of craving to one of nourishment and generosity and a way to show care. So I think that's a very skillful use of the senses. Just guard against it. And that's why sense restraint helps there too. You know, the sense restraint helps to guard the mind from slipping into the unwholesome whilst practicing mudita. I hope that makes some sense. That's just what came to mind. So I'm coming to Diana. I think you had your hand up next, and then to Johnny. Hi.
Hi, Venerable Chanda.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you, you too. While we were reading the sutta, or while you were reading it, I was noticing all of the places where it was happening in this moment. So, for instance, there was this crackling sound along with the voice, and I was like, oh, that's not good. And I was looking who might be unmuted. And so all these like repulsive were happening, like aversion. And wanting, you know, the sound to stop. And then I'm just like, well, it's just the sound. Like, I can still hear you. And I can read along. And then I often like feel these little bumps on my skin, and I just kind of unconsciously start picking them off. And I think that that's, again, like a repulsion. Like, I don't like that feeling. Like, it's and or also, you know, there might be other associations with it. That, and then, so that was interesting. And then it reminded me of yesterday when the leaf blower was outside. I don't know if you have those
in England. Yeah, I find them very ineffective.
Ineffective, and they're so loud, and people, it's like a motorcycle practically constantly revving up. And you know, I have no control over that. Like, it's going on outside. And I found a solution by putting on music. Jackson 5 Greatest Hits, which put me in a happy mood, but I knew I was just covering it up.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess that's not wrong, but again, it's looking for something pleasant to, you know, take the place of the unpleasant instead of just being with what is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's true that when we become more contented with what is, and we sort of, start to soften those reactions, we're less likely to need to offset things. I noticed that in India when I was traveling, you know, in the past, I guess I was absolutely obsessed really with certain rock music. And, you know, I just enjoyed it. And I loved to sort of roll in it for hours and hours and hours. But actually, when I was in India, it felt like a distraction from what was happening right in front of me, which was just being with the local people, hearing the different languages being spoken, hearing the chickens kind of squawking above on the bus, and just being much more present to what was right around me. So, and I found that the more I practiced, the less, actually, even after one course, I hardly needed to listen to music anymore. And I didn't think it was a need. I just thought I'd do it because I enjoy it. But I was so sort of content inside, and I guess more accustomed to a quiet mind, that I actually found the music quite agitating compared to that. So, yeah, you're right. It's not wrong in and of itself, but it isn't necessary either when we learn to just make peace with the noise. Yeah. And a lot of it is the thinking. I mean, as soon as you said about the leaf blower, I thought, what stupid things they are, you know? Whereas actually what's really happening is sound, loud sound, and unwanted sound. So it's great. I mean, the Buddha's teachings are for the purpose of highlighting what's happening to us right now, so it's wonderful that even by talking about this we start to have direct experience of what the Buddha's pointing to. But just to highlight again another couple of words that stuck out to me was how we're being pulled, but also it uses the word intent upon, you know? So it's like we're pulled, and being intent upon is like sort of going out there after something, isn't it? It's like sometimes we're not even aware we're doing it, but we're determined to kind of seek that particular input. And it's that's the issue. It's not having the input that's the problem. It's kind of being so focused and intent upon it that's the problem.
Yeah, and maybe also all the past associations, like it built up like a layer of aversion. I hate that sound. I hate that sound. Yeah. I hate that sound. So even if it's way in the distance, I'm like, I hate that sound. I immediately jump to that, or with perfumes, I have the same issue. Like,
absolutely. We build this kind of repertoire of past memories, and it's really silly because every moment is new, actually. So, maybe we can sort of sometimes preempt it. You know, say it's something that happens regularly. We can prime our mindfulness beforehand to say, okay, when I hear that sound, I know that I'm likely to get triggered or whatever. I will intentionally establish more mindfulness before that happens and notice my reaction.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because then it's like we're taking a little bit more responsibility rather than feeling like victims. You know, this sound's going to happen, I'm going to react. And you sort of know how it goes. Yeah. Okay, we have lots of hands up. So I'm coming to Johnny next. And then I'll come to a comment in the chat and the rest of you. Hi.
Hello, Venerable. Thank you very much for the session. It's been great. My question.
Yet.
And may I continue, sir? My question is quite similar to, I think, Joseph's. It is asking about wholesome ways of relating to the five senses. But I think the difference is that Joseph's question was more about kind of a generosity movement, and my question will be about a kind of self-nourishment movement.
So self-nourishment,
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So Thich Nhat Hanh a lot teaches a lot that to connect with the what is joyful in present moment, like the beauty of the clouds or the bird song or the tea and the taste, and really be using that as a kind of way of nourishing oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So how would that relate to the sutta?
Yeah, that's a great question. The simile that comes to mind for that is actually one from about working with thought. And I think you could probably apply it to this as well. And it's the simile of almost displacing unwholesome thoughts with slightly better thoughts. So it's a kind of gradual step towards having no thoughts. And it might be similar here, you know, that we're kind of replacing maybe the coarser inputs that are less wholesome with input that's still sensory, but a lot more aligned with the Dhamma, in the sense that nature is something that can teach us, right? Nature can teach us about impermanence. It can teach us that everything decays. It can be very beautiful. It can be very peaceful and tranquilizing. And the Buddha, you know, loved to meditate outside under trees. You know, there's poems in the Theragata and probably the Theragata, but I remember them most from the poems of the elder monks, where they'd go outside and relish the nature. They'd say, these rocky crags delight my heart, you know, with the moss and the water trickling and the little deer that are all around us. And they'd write beautiful poetry about this. Even the most austere and kind of hardcore rag robe wearing monks, you know, would become all kind of soft and sentimental about the beautiful nature around them, because it was conducive to settling the mind. So I think it's a kind of stepping stone, a little bit like you say, like Joseph said about, you know, maybe connecting something like food with a wholesome deed or with a sense of joy in giving, joy in offering the food. Actually, that's even more of a renunciation as well. You're not indulging in the food yourself, you're giving it to someone else. So that is another way, you know, just sharing some of the things that we have so we don't grasp onto them so tightly, but we share them with others. So I would say it's a kind of stepping stone, but even further than that, once we start to deepen our meditation practice, we can certainly settle the mind through being in nature, having a walk, having a lovely cup of tea. You know, I was thinking about starting meditation here and having like beautiful oolong tea that we drink, and then we pause and we just calm our mind, and then we actually meditate, you know, because some tea is really conducive to just developing a sense of clarity in the mind. But it's only a preliminary, and you're not going, you know, the idea of the practice is that we become independent of those supports. So, I mean, even more important, I think, for myself and maybe many of us in this busy life where we all seem so rushed and too busy most of the time is to have lots of rest and also to have good company with wise people. This is really, really nourishing, much more so than even a walk outside for me personally. Like having goodness around me and being able to rejoice, you know, in the qualities I see in others and in myself, although I'm less well practiced in that, is a source for enormous joy. So, yeah, that's cultivation of the mind.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I'll just come to a comment in the chat so as not to to ignore the people who want to write their question or comment, and then I'll come to the others with their hands up. So in the opening sentence, why is the bhikkhu, that's the monk he's talking to, or the monk as an example, described as already having wounded and festering limbs, venturing into the wood and stepping on the thorn and being hurt further? Is this description to emphasize that previous indulgence in the senses is what caused the wounds, and so indulgence again would worsen the wound, strengthen the craving for a particular object? It's wonderful that you've asked the question, because to be honest, it didn't occur to me at the time, but I think he's talking about the senses themselves being wounds, being like open wounds. So even deeper than that, he's kind of talking about them as being places that infections can come in, if you like, places that that can be damaged if we don't use them correctly. So we have to protect them. And I think that's related to my favorite translation of guarding the senses. I prefer that to sense restraint. So I think it's understanding that, you know, it's not that the eye or the nose or the ears or anything are bad, but the things that are coming in have a strong tendency to intoxicate the mind. We are still not beyond craving and aversion. And we have to be careful. We have to guard these things. So I think that's what it's talking about. And the objects themselves are like the things that scratch, or what does it say? Yeah, like kusa thorns. So they would prick and the blade reeds would slash their limbs if we're not careful. Yeah. But of course, if we've already indulged, then our minds, I suppose, are less... there's less clarity, so we're less likely to be aware of how we're being affected by sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touches. And we've got bad habits as well. The mindfulness is going to be weak. And yeah, I mean, if we break our sila, the same thing, right? We break our sila because we're not guarding our senses. Normally, that's one of the causes for that. So we have to be even more careful. But I think he's referring to the senses themselves. Yeah. All right. I'll come to Darren now.
Hello, Venerable.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, just thank you again for this evening and for everything that you do. It's, it's just a comment, really. I've been suffering from, suffer from tinnitus and have done for about 12 years. And when I think about it, it's there and it's permanently there. But then when I let it be or just think about other things, then it goes. And I've been on a number of silent retreats and meditations, and when I'm not thinking about it, whilst it's there, it's not there. And it's, I suppose, having that acceptance around it and just letting it be. Now, because I'm talking about it, it's just
there.
Really high-pitched ringing in my ear. But I know when I go into meditation or when I go to sleep, I'm not losing sleep over it. I just think about I suppose, the power of the mind. If I'm focusing on something, then everything else starts to blot out. And like if I say, well, I'm not going to think about pink elephant wearing a tiara, there, and I'm just thinking about that pink elephant. Whereas if I just let it be and let my thoughts be, then the sound starts to dissipate and just fade into the background like a white noise. And it's got me thinking, perhaps I could do that with other areas of my life as well. Letting those things be. And then it just drifts off into the background, so I can then, focus on the wholesome things.
Right. Yeah. It's a good approach because you're letting it drift. I like that sort of language that you're using, rather than kind of zoning it out intentionally, but just letting it be there, but letting it be in the background and widening the perspective or the realm of the field of your awareness to include more, and to try and include really beautiful things, even funny things. Did you say wearing a tiara? I thought you did. So we can now look forward to the Ministry of Silly Hats. And we won't ask any questions. We'll understand exactly why you're doing it. Or teddy bears. Teddy bears is a good one. And the other thing I just add to it is that sometimes we think we're letting things be, right? We like to think there's this thing like unconditional awareness or kind of bare awareness, but actually there can be a certain brittleness or a certain contraction in the awareness itself. So just see that you're adding the kindness to that letting be. Mm. You know, I think you are, because I know you and I know you're very soft and gentle, and you know, just the way you describe letting be, it sounds like it's already dissolving some of the intensity around the sound. But sometimes just to actually actively infuse that awareness with warmth, with genuine warmth and acceptance, and even welcoming that tinnitus, even welcoming the sound, rather than just like, okay, I'm letting you be, I don't really like you, but I suppose you can be there, but really I want to be with something else. Sometimes it's like, okay, I'm just going to totally soften with the sound, as if the sound is my companion. You can even, I mean, this is playing with perception, but you could even perhaps, and I'm not speaking from the experience of tinnitus, it might be not so easy, so just ignore it if it doesn't apply, but perhaps you could even imagine it as this sort of companion, you know, this kind of reassuring kind of stillness. I don't know if that's possible at all, but see if you can play. I know that Ajahn Brahm had a monk in his monastery, and his brother came to visit him, and he said, well, there isn't any space for your brother, so you have to stay in your room. So the monk said, okay, but my brother snores. So he knew he wasn't going to get any sleep. So before his brother started snoring, he did some metta meditation and sort of tried to get really relaxed. And then he just tried to imagine the snoring like the most sonorous music in the world, and just, you know, kind of imagined its rhythm and its... And he actually managed to drift off to sleep. So, and he said, oh, yeah, it sounded really nice by the end. So who knows? It might be different with something that's there all the time. I'm not sure. But yeah. So I'm going to come to Suzanne, because you've not asked a question yet. And I know that you wait to the end. So I want to make sure you're included. And then I'll come to the last two people with their hands up. I'll fit you in. Recently, I was in a state of emotional discomfort, anticipating a phone call with someone that I have a complicated relationship with. During my meditation, I could feel how my mind was looking for something in the other person that would make me happy. Then I stopped my mind going into this expectation. I experienced that my mind actually is already that happiness and joy when it rests in itself. What a relief. Because you've cultivated happiness and joy in the mind. I don't think the mind is anything intrinsically happy or sad. The mind is just the mind. It's just awareness. But you've put those qualities in there. You've cultivated those qualities. And now they're coming up quite readily when you call upon them. So that's really wonderful. And this is the whole realm of how we use, you could call it restraint of the mind, right? Cultivation, guarding of the mind. And that's a huge realm. And certainly this is a realm where we can substitute one kind of thought for another. And intentionally look for the opposite way to perceive a situation. The Buddha talks about this all the time in the suttas, different types of perceptions that are skillful. And one of the most common examples of sense restraint is just to purposely look for something good in another person rather than focusing on their faults. So that's wonderful, and that's definitely guarding the senses and recognizing the importance of the mind. So I'm coming to Hot now.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, the sutta and also what Diana said reminded me of a quote that I heard during my yoga teacher training, which was, the noise does not disturb you, you disturb the noise. And just how, like, the perception of what you're getting through your senses is actually, like, what's causing you pleasure or discomfort, perhaps.
Yeah, yes, certainly intensifying it, but if not creating it, absolutely. Because the more we, you know, land on the idea that this is something unwanted, I don't like this, I don't want this, we're immediately perceiving it as something negative. It's so funny that that was used in your yoga training, because that's actually a direct quote about Jan Cha. And I don't know who your yoga teacher trainer might be, but they may well have been to listen to some of Ajahn Brahm's talks or read some of Ajahn Chah's books, because he uses that quite a lot. So.
Yeah, I do know. It's very interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because you think, no, that can't be the case. Surely some things are more disturbing than others. But are they really? I mean, for the fully enlightened arahat, nothing is a disturbance anymore. So, yeah, thanks for that comment. It's really helpful, isn't it, to question the nature of reality and the way that we see reality and start to realize we're actually creating it in our mind. So, last question for tonight, most probably. Hello.
Hello, Venerable Shonda.
Hello.
This is my first time at the meeting, so I'm really gaining a lot of knowledge here. My one question with the senses is, there's a lot of suffering in the world that we see. And the more I practice meditation, the more compassion I have, it seems to grow. And I find it difficult when I'm in a situation where it's hard to guard my senses. You know, if you see something on TV, you can turn the channel or you can not look away. But if you're immersed in a situation where you see innocents suffering, but you're not able to do anything, I'm wondering, I guess, how you don't have control, but how you can control that emotion of...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not something that I have happen, luckily, on a regular basis, but I'm sure there are a lot of people that do see, you know, animals suffering or, and they can't do anything about it other than, you know, look away. So I'm not really sure I'm asking the question properly.
Yeah, I think I understand where you're coming from, hopefully. And if not, you could try and elaborate a bit more. I mean, one thing that I noticed in the way you phrased that was this idea that, you know, not being able to really control our response, and that's okay. You know, I think it's really important that we feel the pain of life from time to time, and we allow ourselves to trust that that can give rise to compassion. You said that a compassion arises for you, which is wonderful. One of the proximate causes for compassion, of course, if not the proximate cause in the Buddhist text, is right view. And what is right view other than an appreciation and understanding of suffering, that all beings are basically subject to suffering and do suffer. It's not just that we will suffer someday. It's like this is the realm of suffering that we're born into. And because of delusion, you know, we actually exacerbate the suffering. in this world, you know, through our unskillful ways of body, speech, and mind. So it's important to be able to learn to stay with some of that discomfort and sadness, and to learn to relate to it with kindness and with compassion. And this is creating a sort of foundation for us to be able to respond with compassion as and when we can. So I think one thing that I might do is to perhaps reflect after a situation like this, that in that situation, there was nothing I could do. So, you know, despite my wish for these beings to be happy, these beings are suffering right now, and then develop some equanimity. But then perhaps recognize that there are situations in your life that you can add some, you know, you can have active compassion in a way that's going to help. There are some things you can do. So to work on those, because, I mean, when I hear the news and I hear about the rise of fascism in many places, but, you know, in the US and you know, actually in many places, probably including the UK, it can lead you into a sense of despair. But then at the same time, we were talking this evening about how more people are coming to monasteries, more people are getting interested in renouncing, you know. When we're practicing on the path and we're surrounded by good people, we see those people grow and we see their qualities increase. So this is happening also in the world. And sometimes it's important to put our energy where we can be effective. And that resources us to have more wisdom and more compassion and more resilience too when we see the suffering in the world. So I don't think we have to control our emotions and avoid looking at that which is distressing. But I mean, it's important to notice whether it's really helpful as well. Like watching the news, for example, is not an obligation.
Right.
I mean, I think it's enough just to get a very quick bulletin of objective news for the day, if you really want to, or for the week, and know that you're being informed with as many kind of safeguards in place as possible. You're not getting pulled into conspiracy theories or kind of weird takes on things, you know, but there's some sort of actual reality to that that you're hearing, but only enough so that compassion can arise and that you have a realistic idea of the world you live in. And perhaps, I mean, for me, it's very interesting to explore the kind of view and psychology that underpins a lot of these horrible things that we see in the world, to check that I'm not moving in that direction myself. But beyond that, I think it wouldn't do me any good at all to just constantly read the news and get this kind of the fight flight system really triggered, because then I couldn't bring peace to others. I would be part of the spin, if you like. And that's what people want to happen, you know, political leaders that want to dictate. They want to create chaos. They want to have us, you know, discombobulated, Jim Brehm's favorite word, so that we don't know what we're doing, and we feel out of control, we feel despair, and then we let these guys take over. So it's really important to feel that we're somehow able to protect and guard our minds and ourselves and our well-being while still being well informed. Does that make sense? That was a bit kind of
yes it does. I like that where you say, you know, where can you help in another way maybe, but
yeah. Yeah, because nobody can be everything for everyone and work in every area of life. That's why we have specializations, isn't it? And some people are teachers, some people are taxi drivers, some people are Buddhist monastics, not very many. There's still room if you want to try. Yeah, so, you know, we need everybody's skills, and more than our skills, we need our good intentions in the ways that we help others. It can be the most humble of jobs, but if you do it with a smile and you do it with a genuine sense that I'm doing this to serve, you know, I'm trying to bring value to the society, the people around me, then it's a very beautiful thing to do.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So we're pretty much out of time. Okay, there's lots of ideas coming from the chat about a flower trip. I don't know if I've had enough to talk about for only about flowers, the danger, the escape of the beauty of flowers. I don't know. I think it's okay to enjoy flowers, but it's a very nice idea, a flower trip. Okay, I'm reading your ideas and taking them in. Would you consider using concrete examples such as holding a flower up during the class and walk us through how you contemplate the arising, passing away, gratification, danger, and escape of the beauty of the flower? Or maybe a candle. I see there's a candle on the shelf behind you. I've never really thought of that. I will consider it. All right. So, it's my turn to hand over for the last 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And you didn't get away without a spotlight.
Oh, you put me on the spotlight.
I did indeed.
And thank you, Venerable, for that wonderful explanations and the answers that you have given and teaching us. And thank you all for being a wonderful community. And now I'd like to say a few words about the beautiful enabling quality of generosity. Giving is a whole thrust of the practice, a direction we move in that goes against the stream of wanting and amazing, and develops wholesome qualities that form the foundation of our Dhamma practice. The Buddha said that the wisest way to give is when one gives with the heart full of joy, for the purpose of beautifying the mind and for equipping the mind for the practice of serenity and insight. That's taken from Anguttara 8.33. So, here at Anukampa, we offer several ways that you can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. You can do a one-time donation, any amount, and either here. So, I put a link here. You can do it on the website, or you can do it from the PayPal or through a direct bank transfer. If you are able, you can do a standing order, which is quite helpful as well. And there are other ways. You can offer to drop in as a volunteer. You can contact our team at anukampaproject.org and get all the details tell what kind of things that you are able to do, what are your strengths of volunteering. As you know, we've got events, we've got so many other things that you can volunteer. You can provide meals, team at Anukampa, and find when it is good to give the meal. You can do it as a delivery as well. You don't have to travel to the monastery. There are ways of sending groceries and other household items to monastery. We've got the needed items list on the website as well. Thank you very much for coming and being part of the community.
Thank you so much, Minori. One more thing that came to mind, because I know that some of you are actually in Oxford or near Oxford, that we have got a local WhatsApp group or a locals WhatsApp group for people that live somewhere nearby. And that means that if we have some event or if we have some kind of busy bee day or sort of deep clean of the monastery, we could contact you and let you know. So if you're interested in being involved in that way, you could also write to the team or just send them your phone number and I can add you to that community. And there is a newsletter coming out as soon as I can have the energy to write it. It takes a few days and we're all pretty tired, actually, after Bhattisajato's tour. It was absolutely fantastic. The really wonderful thing for me was like having a brother around. It was really like we had this sibling connection. It was so cool because I don't have a big brother, but now I do. And it was lovely. And he was so open and generous and inspiring to be around, just very, very easy. So we've talked a lot, so I'm quite tired, but so the newsletter will come out, and in there I'll probably have a few busy bee days organized, I hope. And there's also Ajahn Brahm's 2-hour Dhamma session, and with a bit of fundraising added on the 15th of February. That should be on our events page. So there's still about 3 places left, so it's going to be really full. And if you can't come and you've registered and you can't come, please just cancel. I think there's a cancel thing on the confirmation email, because it will be really full. There's always a few dropouts on the day, so it's still worth applying if you wish to come. All right. And tomorrow morning, Metta. That's right, isn't it? Tomorrow morning, Metta Meditation, 9 a.m. GMT. So take care, everybody. I think for Sanaya now, it's either really early in the morning or it's like really late at night. But hopefully the Metta session might work. All right, so we're going to unmute you all now and hear your lovely voices so we can say goodbye. And it's really a blessing to see you all, I have to say, old and new.